Joe Manchin saves Joe Biden's bacon. The Chinese rattle their sabers to discourage Nancy Pelosi. Republicans contemplate how to investigate the pandemic response. And just who the heck is still running the Editors podcast this week? We'll discuss all that and more on this edition of The Editors. Both Rich Lowry and Charlie Cook are still out on vacation, which means I, Jim Garrity, still have the keys to the podcasting studio. And you know what that means, don't you? It means we're going to party like a raging kegger at Brett Kavanaugh's house. I am joined by our WonderCon, Jimmy Quinn, who seems to know everything there is to know about China. No pressure, Jimmy. And Michael Brendan Doherty, who you know as the gregarious MBD. He's not all that notorious. This is the point in the podcast where Rich would usually remind you that if for some reason you're not already following the Editors podcast on a streaming service, you can find us everywhere from Spotify to iTunes, and that we welcome your five-star reviews. And if you think this podcast doesn't deserve five stars, what's wrong with you? Don't share an opinion like that. People will scoff at you. They'll make fun of you. They'll deride you for it. When it comes to our reviews, go big or go home. Our sponsors this episode are NetChoice, as well as the spectacular sheets of Bull and Branch, and Brad Thor's new thriller novel, Rising Tiger. In fact, let's hear from NetChoice right now, because they would like you to know that new polling shows 65% of Americans blame President Biden and the Democrats for rising inflation. If Republicans stand on a unified platform to fight inflation, they're likely going to do very well in this year's midterm elections. But some lawmakers, like Representative Buck, are degrading that strategy by backing proposals which 85% of Americans believe will make inflation worse. The last thing Republicans should be doing ahead of the midterms is supporting progressive pet projects. Just 1% of voters say they want Congress to focus on tech regulation, while 60% say they want lawmakers to focus on inflation. To win in November, Republicans should listen to the people and fight back against inflationary regulations pushed by progressives. Join NetChoice in urging lawmakers to oppose Democrat pet projects like S-2992 and tell Congress to focus on the issues that matter most to you. Learn more about this fight to send a letter to your representatives at netchoice.org/2992. This message was brought to you by NetChoice. So, Michael, you and I sometimes overlap on the Editors podcast, sometimes we don't. And it feels like for almost a year before we start taping, we're talking about what to discuss. Someone, often Rich, but not always, will say, there's some movement on Build Back Better, or, Manchin made a comment and it looks like he's going around. And for a year, it's felt like the story has been going around in circles. Oh, Manchin might be doing it. Oh, no, Manchin's backing away from it. Oh, Manchin's coming back. Well, this week, Manchin said he could agree not to the usual Build Back Better, but a somewhat slimmed down version that they're now calling the Inflation Reduction Act. And now Democrats think they can get a big chunk of that their original agenda passed before the midterms. I will not ask, as Rich usually does, what do you make of it? I will simply ask, Michael, what do you think?
Well, I am surprised, I have to say, because even though Joe Manchin has never made much sense to me when he explains his rationales for things, he had been relatively clear that he was primarily concerned about inflation and didn't want more spending. And it's not a very Joe Manchin-y bill, even in this form, except for the name, Reduce Inflation Act. But when you look into what's in it, it's just a skinnier Build Back Better. There's, some nods toward deficit reduction in the sense of there's tax increases and some estimates about, $125 billion is going to be recovered by IRS tax enforcement somehow. Or closing, the carried interest loophole for another $15 billion in revenue, those sorts of things. But, the heart of the bill is, $385 billion in subsidies, tax credits, and loans to green energy companies, basically. And that could have some inflationary effect rather than having a disinflationary one, which is what the bill advertises. So I don't get Joe Manchin's thinking at all, but maybe just the simple rebranding of it, calling it an Inflation Reduction Act, is enough for him.
Jimmy, you mostly pay attention to Chinese issues, but I'm sure you've three, two, one. Jimmy, I know your beat is usually issues relating to China, but clearly this was one of the bigger news of items of the week. What do you make of Manchin's sudden about face?
Sure. Well, Jim, I think the most important thing to note here, at least one significant aspect that has kind of flown under the radar, is how Senate Republicans paved the way for this new version of the proposal to be introduced. Senator McConnell a few weeks ago had said, if Democrats move forward with this reconciliation package, that Senate Republicans would hold up the CHIPS and Science Act, which was this massive industrial policy bill to give billions and billions of dollars to the semiconductor manufacturers and higher education institutions for scientific research. And what happened was Republicans got with the CHIPS Act and they, passed it. 17 Republicans voted for it, this week. And immediately, just right after that, Manchin and Schumer came out and they said that they'd been, negotiating this new version of Build Back Better. And, they're going to move it down the field. I'm not even sure that, most Republicans knew exactly what was in the CHIPS Act when they voted for it. There's a lot of lobbying by the higher education industry and civil rights groups to remove provisions that would have put guardrails on U.S. funding that could have gone to, say, semiconductor manufacturing in China. But whatever the case, we're here now, and this is, a second significant potential legislative victory that congressional Democrats and the Biden administration seem to be on the verge of, pushing across the finish line right ahead of the August recess.
I mean, Jimmy, for a guy who's usually considered shrewd and one step ahead of the opposition, I mean, is it safe to say Mitch McConnell got rolled here?
I think, Senate leadership as a whole did get rolled here. To his credit, McConnell has consistently opposed the CHIPS bill. But Senate Republicans, frankly, could have done a lot more. And there's a strong case to be made that, yes, we do need to help boost CHIPS manufacturing here in the U.S., but a lot of the extraneous provisions that were included in the legislation, such as creating a chief diversity officer within the National Science Foundation, carve outs for Confucius Institute hosted or universities that host Confucius Institutes, they're able to receive funding. So there's a lot of stuff that, people just kind of held their, nose on and moved forward with this.
I think one of the aspects that jumped out to me the most about this is just like 2 weeks ago, Joe Manchin was saying, well, before he made any decision on whether he could use reconciliation and whether he could support any version of this bill, he just had to see what the July inflation numbers would look like. Well, listeners, you probably know we're not out of July yet. And in fact, those numbers don't get published until August 10th. So, and oh, by the way, to the extent, various economists go out there and do various projections, one at it thinking, expecting it's going to be 9.2%, which would actually be worse than June's 9.1%. I think Kiplinger is saying you should expect something in the ballpark of 9% for the rest of the year. So it's not like anything's changed regarding inflation. And so I think it's safe to say that Manchin, when he says, I really need to see X, he doesn't need to see X. And I kind of feel like we're getting into, he's the, Senate equivalent of Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy, where it seemed like what he was going to decide depended on what side of the bed he got out every morning. So, Michael, do you think we've cut, for the much of the Biden era, Joe Manchin has been the roadblock or the speed bump that has slowed down a lot of progressive wishes. Did folks on the right maybe over-romanticize or overhype Manchin's willingness to defy the rest of his party?
Maybe, but I mean, we do have to be honest here. This is dramatically slimmed down and less dangerous to pass than the original vision of Build Back Better, which was going to be like a New Deal size reconstruction of the federal government and its relationship to Americans. This is something much less, it's going to be less inflationary than Build Back Better would have been if it had been passed in its original form, the way that House Democrats wanted it to be passed along with the infrastructure bill. So in that sense, Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema saved us from total disaster. But this is just like a grab bag of corporate, you know, green corporate giveaways and a little bit of nibbling around in healthcare and, you know, on drug prices. That's, you know, that's a significant come down, even if it's something that we don't want or we don't think will help in any particular way. You know, and a lot of it's just grifting when you look at it, but it's, yeah, I'm still kind of grateful for the overall effect Joe Manchin has had on the direction of, you know, this Congress. So, yeah, over-romanticized, possibly. I mean, he wasn't. The thing about Joe Manchin is, you said the other side of the bed. It depends on what side of the boat he gets out of. I mean, he is unreadable sometimes. I mean, he will say one thing in the morning and another thing in the afternoon, and they don't exactly line up. I mean, I know our own reporter John McCormick has kind of made this like sideline in trying to interpret Joe Manchin, and it's basically impossible.
So I have a three-part exit question, and each one kind of builds upon the next one. Will the so-called Inflation Reduction Act, will it pass? Will Americans like it? And will it affect the midterms at all? Jimmy, I'll start with you.
I think at this point, it's more likely than not to pass. A lot of different moving pieces need to kind of fit in here. Kyrsten Sinema needs to get on board. You need Democrats like Josh Gottheimer in the House to go along with it. You know, whatever the provisions on, you know, the SALT deduction cap end up, you know, coming out as. So yeah, I do think they'll get it across the finish line. Will Americans like it? We'll see. I think, you know, what you guys have been saying about the potential inflationary effects, you know, is a significant factor here, and it can't be underestimated. So will this be blamed for, continuing, the inflationary trend in a few months? And that sort of, you know, bleeds into, the third question as well. Is this something that, congressional Democrats are going and candidates are going to be able to run on in the midterms? And they're definitely going to try. But will it also be a target for Republican candidates who want to prove that their opponents are, sort of soft on inflation and, doing these frivolous things on climate, as we're entering a recession and, you know, we're already there?
Michael, will it pass? Will Americans like it? And will it affect the midterms at all?
It will pass because I think in general, this mix of priorities is something Sinema can get behind. Maybe there'll be some tinkering at the edges. So I think it'll pass. I think it will help Democrats. It's going to help existing Democrats who want to fend off challenges from greener than thou lefties, that are still going on. And I think it'll help a little bit in that by passing some green legislation, I think that leads to less demoralization among Democrats, and that'll be helpful at just the margins. This isn't going to turn things around for them. Will the American people like it? I mean, I don't know. I expect the inflation numbers to improve over time. I mean, I think David Bahnsen's been sending me some, you know, numbers about different commodities that seem to be disinflating that are giving me some hope. But so I don't think it's going to contribute significantly to inflation. I'm open to it. But, people, I don't know. Will people like it if it makes it easier to buy a fancy Tesla? I don't know. Maybe.
My answers are very much in the ballpark of you guys. It was yes and not really and not really. Because apparently only 20% of Americans know that Congress passed an infrastructure bill. So if people aren't noticing that, I don't see this bill being a game changer, but stranger things have happened. Yeah, guys, I got to tell you, runaway spending bills are terrible, almost as bad as uncomfortable sheets. Did you know the thread count is a myth? I know your world has been shocked to its very foundation. It does not matter how many threads your sheets have if they're not the best threads possible. The signature hemmed sheets from Boll & Branch are a bestseller for a reason. Boll & Branch uses the highest quality threads on earth for a superior softness and a better night's sleep. Sheets are made with threads so luxurious, they're beloved by three U.S. presidents. And I know what you're thinking. Okay, but which three U.S. presidents? They feel buttery to the touch and are super breathable, and they're perfect for every season. And they have more than 10,000 stellar reviews. The annual summer event is over, but Boll & Branch extended our code for exclusive access for 20% off through the end of the month with the promo code EDITORS15 at BollAndBranch.com. This is their best offer of the year before the holidays, so you should act now. All right, so we are moving on to the issue of Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Taiwan. It's a rare moment where folks, many of us on the right, are saying, hey, go, Nancy Pelosi, go. Or maybe we are, but we're saying it, go, Nancy Pelosi, go. We want you to go away. The editors of National Review wrote an editorial went earlier this week and said Nancy Pelosi should go to Taiwan. And no, wise guys, it did not say, and she should stay there. But apparently the Biden administration does not want her to go. Biden had this vague comment that the Pentagon thought it was a bad idea. China has been saber rattling. Jimmy, you are on top of all things regarding this issue and most things in China. How do things stand at this moment?
Sure. So Speaker Pelosi is leaving on a trip to a number of countries in Asia today, I think. So we're talking Japan, South Korea, Malaysia, Singapore. And she might also make a stop in Taiwan. This was leaked to, I think, the Financial Times first about a week ago. And since then, it's touched off a massive, you know, political firestorm where, you know, Biden has kind of weighed in and suggested that the military doesn't want her to go because it's too risky. Meanwhile, White House officials, State Department officials, and Pentagon officials have been briefing Pelosi, saying that there are certain risks involved with her, you know, going on this potential trip. Now, it wouldn't be unprecedented. Newt Gingrich, when he was Speaker of the House, went to Taiwan in 1997. But the naysayers point out this is a different sort of geopolitical environment where, you know, we've been taking a closer or we've been pursuing a closer diplomatic relationship with Taiwan while still staying true to our one China policy. Meanwhile, you know, in Beijing, there's been a lot of saber rattling, a lot of flights through Taiwan's air defense identification zone, and more belligerent rhetoric. So at the end of the day, there's this choice that only Speaker Pelosi can make. The White House can't make it for her. And I think that our editorial line, National Review's editorial line, is correct. She should go. Taiwan is really under the gun right now. Beijing is picking off all of its official diplomatic allies around the world. It's isolating it on the international stage and, you know, essentially preparing this military buildup that could result ultimately in an invasion, you know, sometime in the foreseeable future. So, it's important for this high-ranking official to go and show U.S. support at this time.
I'm going to get to Michael in a second, but Jimmy, I just have a quick follow-up. I saw somebody making the argument that if Pelosi went traveling commercial, now I'm sure she'd go on first class, but you know, the idea that if she didn't go on her own plane that was, you know, considered official business or something like that, but she just took, I don't know whether it's United or you know, whether Taiwan Airlines, some sort of commercial flight that the Chinese would be less likely to harass or do any kind of issue or something like that. Does that make any sense to you? Or does that just kind of seem like, you know, one way or another, the Chinese is going to be equally irked either way?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, when members of Congress go on these congressional delegations to foreign countries, they, you know, are often on aircraft operated by the military. Even if it's more like a passenger type plane for U.S. officials. So that could be, you know, one alternative that the Speaker's office pursues. She'll probably be bringing with her a bipartisan delegation. So, you know, we'll see, you know, what mode of transportation they go with. But I'd imagine that would be a viable option as well.
Michael, you are, I hope you'll be okay with me characterizing you as a non-interventionist or usually non-interventionist, and the non-interventionist who makes me rethink my priors more than probably anybody else. But you're also a person who, based on your universe of writing, I don't see you as someone who underestimates China and the potential threat that it represents. So from your perspective, what's the right play here?
So, you know, I'll be honest, I'm not sure. I think, you know, I have to just outline my thinking here. I'm not sure what to think. China has been making more moves in the Strait, and the rhetoric is at a pitch it's never been at before from Chairman Xi. And I've seen credible analysis, and a friend of mine, Elbridge Colby, who is sort of like the Republican foreign policy advocate who's arguing most strenuously for focusing totally on China right now, and really wrapping our minds around how hard it would be to defend Taiwan and how urgent the need is to put more resources into this question, not just our brains, but like just more physical resources, more buildup for a conflict. And there are signs that, you know, I've even read credible analysis saying that, you know, Chairman Xi could try to effect this reunification with Taiwan before the next big party conference, which would put it next year. And frankly, I find it believable. I mean, I find it totally plausible that he would take advantage of a weak president preparing for re-election, who is bogged down already in what I see as a losing strategy in Ukraine, a lose slowly strategy, and present him with a fait accompli of like, do you want a major war right ahead of re-election over a small island that you don't have an official commitment to? So I think there are some dangers that we are not ready for a full Chinese dynamic response to Pelosi's visit. That I truly believe. However, I don't think China is just yet ready to launch that kind of response. And so therefore it could be useful to, you know, rub their nose in it a bit. So that's sort of where my thinking lies right now. Like, if my calculation is correct, my hunch that China is not ready to make the move yet, then it's a good idea for Pelosi to go. And it kind of enhances our commitment to Taiwan while still remaining ambiguous, which is where I think we should be. But I can see the downside too, which is that we are not prepared, I think, for a full-scale struggle over Taiwan unless China falls on its face immediately. While we're still, while we're still in Syria, while we're still sending a huge amount of military equipment into Eastern Europe, I'm nervous. That's all I'll say.
It's been a weird week when you begin the week by saying, "Hey, you know, Nancy Pelosi wants to be the first speaker since Newt Gingrich to go visit Taiwan. Good for you, Nancy Pelosi." And then I think it was either yesterday or the day before, Senator Menendez of New Jersey, who's not my favorite person in the world, made what seemed like a very compelling argument, which is that, look, if China can effectively veto whether U.S. government officials can go visit Taiwan or not, well, then they kind of effectively control the country already. They control that island, basically. So my instinct is to say, no, screw you, Beijing. You don't get to tell us who can visit when and stuff like that. We're completely free to do this. I'd send them there and, you know, debate about whether I want to send it with a fighter escort. If you really want to escalate this, we can escalate this. But that's probably the sort of thing that why cooler heads than I are in these circumstances. My exit question on this one is going to be another two-parter. And I realize you don't have crystal balls. You don't have a perfect, but what's your gut instinct right now? One, will Pelosi go to Taiwan? And two, if she does, what will the Chinese government do in response? I'll go to you first, Jimmy Quinn.
Yeah, I think it's more likely than not she goes. I saw Josh Rogan of the Washington Post tweeting that sources are, you know, telling him that, you know, they're prepared to make this trip and they're probably going to do it. So that's that. I'm not a military strategist or, you know, an expert on the PLA. But what some people are saying is that one response could be a direct flight of Chinese fighter jets over Taiwan. And, you know, typically when the Chinese try to, you know, express their displeasure with something that's going on, they'll just kind of, you know, send jets across, you know, the midway point in the strait, you know, and they'll kind of go into Taiwan's air defense identification zone, which, you know, it's a technical term. It's not the same as, you know, Taiwan's like territorial airspace. So sending, you know, flights directly over Taiwan would be a major escalation. And I think some experts are saying that that is a possibility.
Michael, your thoughts? Will Pelosi go? And if she does, what will the Chinese do in response?
I think she'll go. I think the Chinese will do something like what Jimmy outlines there, fly over airspace. And I think the North Koreans will then do another test or demonstration as well, just to turn the temperature way up in East Asia and scramble things once again.
I was going to say, I think I agree with both of you. And I hadn't thought about the North Korean aspect, Michael, but that's a very good point that China has other buttons that they can press to antagonize us. The other, you mentioned the anxieties about whether a Chinese invasion of Taiwan, which seemed like a threat of someday, whether someday seems to be getting particularly closer. Look, if you're the Chinese, you don't know who's going to be president in 2024. Or 2025. You don't know who's going to be president further down the road. We saw Biden's response to Afghanistan. We saw Biden's response to Ukraine. We saw how Biden's light schedule, shall we say, and the general lack of energy in the executive that he brings, and just the general sense that he is an exhausted man. This seems like a pretty good time to strike if you think American leadership will be wavering and indecisive and easily intimidated, particularly.
Right. And go ahead. Particularly, you know, like the big advocate for China, for Japanese rearmament has just been assassinated. You know, this is potentially a hugely opportune time for China just to announce, like, we're creating a new order in the Pacific.
And then the other last thing, and I realize we're, you know, in a, for an exit question, we're taking a long time getting to the exit, but that's fine. China has this weird real estate investment crisis going on and all kinds of economic turmoil and the shutdown in the cities and stuff like that. So I've wondered, is Xi Jinping the kind of guy who looks at all kinds of domestic troubles and says, ah, well, this would be a terrible time to invade Taiwan. I don't want to throw one more major challenge on top of it, everything else. Or does he look at it and say, you know what would make everybody feel better? A grand, great patriotic war to reclaim Taiwan that is always meant to be ours. You know, that'll make everybody feel good. You know, and if it seems unreasonable, hey, that was kind of Putin's thinking too. So I will move on. So, you know, this is actually a perfect segue to our third sponsor, because if you're thinking about, you know, geopolitical instability and threats and national security, there's nobody better to read if you're trying to feel absolutely tense and at the edge of your seat and white knuckled while you're trying to relax on the beach. There's nobody better than Brad Thor. From number one New York Times bestselling author Brad Thor comes a riveting new thriller, Rising Tiger. When the Chinese military launches a barbaric attack on India, not Taiwan, but India, America's top spy is drawn into the fray. But in the fight for democracy, who's the predator and who's the prey? Best Thriller Books raves that thriller fans of all stripes will devour this book. Read or listen to Rising Tiger today, available now in hardcover, ebook, and as an audiobook, read by Armand Schultz. Well, then there's kind of this other issue relating to China. You may remember this little cold that was going around, this little virus that they brought to us from the Wuhan Institute of Virology. Oh, I'm sorry. It's like allegedly, it's apparently, you know, nobody really knows exactly where it came from. Maybe the you know, the pangolin sneezed on somebody, and that's how this all got started. My distinguished colleague Michael Brennan Doherty had a really good piece this week discussing what a Republican House, or who knows, maybe even a Republican Senate, should investigate regarding the American government's pandemic response if and when they take over in January. Michael, would you mind walking us through your thinking on this?
So my thinking is that I've seen a lot of commentary recently saying that the COVID-19 is not the most salient issue anymore. It's inflation and it's the economy and it's any number of other things. But of course, I think that's actually a kind of a false choice in that inflation was in many ways caused by the collective global response to COVID-19, which is, let's put tons of money out the door. At the same time, we're shutting down production of goods and services. You know, it's kind of obvious in retrospect that inflation would be the result. And further, I think it's also just a sign that people are saying, I'm not concerned about COVID personally anymore. I'm vaxxed, I'm boosted, I've already had it, maybe all three, and, you know, I don't need it anymore. But the fact is, there's a lot we don't really understand about our response. And I saw in the past week, Deborah Birx kind of unburdening herself, saying stuff like, I knew the vaccines wouldn't be that effective against, you know, new variants, or effective at stopping transmission, which makes you wonder, like, who else thought that and when and how early. You know, she said that they were oversold. You know, this, the overselling was a deliberate policy that was used to prop up federal vaccine mandates that led to people getting fired, court-martialed, et cetera. If they were already convinced at the top levels of public health that they weren't going to prevent transmission, I'd want to know, when did they make that determination for themselves? When did they know that? When did, Dr. Fauci this week has said two things that were just stunning, which was, one, he said that if he'd known now about what he knows about COVID, if he knew it then, he would have advocated for much stricter measures to contain the virus. But at the same time, he's said, I never advocated for lockdown. But, you know, my friend and peer, Noah Rothman over at Commentary, found all sorts of times when, going back to 2020, when Dr. Fauci gave interviews saying, I advocated to the president shutting the country down. You know, I think we need a full kind of, you know, almost 9/11 style report timeline of what were our pandemic plans beforehand, because this is something that most governments had on their shelves, rotting somewhere, which was, we expect respiratory pandemics in the future. What is our plan for them? What was done with that plan? Why did it shift towards the Italian style and Chinese style lockdowns? What did people know and when, and what was the policy for changing or evaluating CDC recommendations? I mean, it took almost 6 months for the science that COVID-19 was airborne to kind of filter into CDC evaluations and recommendations. You know, what about, you know, we've seen reporting that the 6 feet distancing policy was kind of a guess. So I'd like Congress to confirm that, you know, that the initial recommendation from some medical authorities was 10 feet. But then people said, no one knows what 10 feet is, but people know roughly the size of a human is 6 feet. So let's say 6 feet. You know, I'd like to know everything about how these decisions came to, what authority they had, in the sense that what scientific backing they had at the time, because millions of people, I think, have been put off by the behavior of public health officials in the last 2.5-3 years. They're horrified by the response. They felt gaslit by the country's response, and I think they just deserve an accounting for what happened and why it happened. And in fact, I think the accounting could help explain too. It could be exculpatory in some ways, which is that Fauci and others were working with extremely limited information, and they were working with extreme demands from the public to get this sorted as quickly as possible. They were working with extreme uncertainty with Donald Trump as president. All those things were factors. I mean, it's clear in Birx's memoirs that, in effect, she would advocate for, you know, 50% of what she wanted, because she thought, if I can get the 50% from Trump, then I could establish a beachhead to get, you know, the 70% solution. And then that's a new beachhead, which I could get my next idea. So, you know, I want an accounting of this time. I feel like we are ready to forget. You know, the World Health Organization hasn't really followed up with its own examination of what happened in Wuhan. I mean, it literally set up a kind of blue ribbon commission to investigate the origins of the virus that was heavily stacked in favor of finding, you know, the pangolin or the bat, the natural cause. And it still couldn't find that. It still couldn't rule out a lab leak. You know, I'd love for Congress to sit through both the intelligence reports and the public health reports on this. I mean, what was that meeting that Fauci had, right? Where he said, like, you have work to do today. I mean, that email is still out there, and it's the subject of immense amounts of conspiracy theories. Well, let's put an end to that. Let's find out what actually happened.
It would be absolutely spectacular to see a investigation into the origin of the virus that did not rely on the cooperation or information from the Chinese government. And so far, we do not have that, unless you want to count the intelligence community's investigation, which came out with we don't know. It's weird. We couldn't find it. Anybody, your guess is as good as ours. Way to go, intelligence community. Way to go. Jimmy Quinn, let's assume Republicans win the House. Let's be optimistic and assume they win the Senate and they've got decent majorities. And, you know, McCarthy and McConnell or whoever's leading them come to you and say, well, we're going to investigate a lot of stuff, but what should we investigate the most? What would your answer be?
Jim, I don't even know where to start with that. I have so many ideas, but, you know, on the COVID front, you know, yes, they should absolutely investigate origins. And I think that, you know, in the minority, Republicans have tried to do their best to get answers. You know, without the ability to, you know, schedule hearings themselves or, you know, exercise the subpoena power. So if they are to win that, we're going to see a major, major push on that front. And I don't think that's much of a secret. It'll be interesting to see the direction they go there. And I would just add, you know, to what Michael was saying about origins. There's this really interesting statement that the State Department put out on January 15, 2021. So this was right before the end of the Trump administration. And basically, it was all about this activity that was going on at the Wuhan Institute of Virology. Now, State didn't come out and say one way or another, you know, this is definitely a lab leak or definitely, you know, more exclusively a zoonotic origin type incident from a wet market. But what they did say is that there was secret military activity at the Wuhan Institute of Virology, that the PLA was there, you know, doing all sorts of classified research, you know, laboratory animal experiments on behalf of, you know, the Chinese military since 2017. And there's a whole paper trail to exploit there, given, you know, sort of the involvement of the NIH, U.S., you know, grantees of, you know, the NIH, such as EcoHealth Alliance, which is run by Peter Daszak, who was, you know, obviously one of the main characters in this whole COVID origins debate that really was huge last year, is obviously, you know, well, Jim, given your coverage of the situation. So, you know, if Republicans win a majority in either the House or the Senate, they're going to be prepared to start issuing subpoenas, calling witnesses, and really digging into these investigations with much larger staffs, probably on multiple congressional committees. It's interesting because, you know, Republicans have been pushing for this for a while. You know, Democratic committee chairmen haven't really, you know, done much on this front, but it is somewhat of a bipartisan issue. In the Senate, there was support from certain Senate Democrats for, you know, resolutions that called for investigations of, you know, the COVID pandemic, including the origins issue. You know, we're going to see a lot more action, I think, after January, especially if, you know, the GOP gets at least the House. Otherwise, you know, I think we can expect, you know, some of the typical investigations that people are already talking about, Hunter Biden, Afghanistan, you know, probably some stuff related to, you know, energy policy and sort of, you know, the climate change agenda, issues that I'm tracking specifically that, you know, haven't really, you know, made it to like the center of attention. McKinsey's work with China. I just had a piece about this yesterday. Senator Rubio sent a letter along with several other Republican lawmakers demanding, you know, information from McKinsey about its work with the Chinese government, which McKinsey, you know, continues to deny, saying it never worked with the central government of China, despite, you know, some evidence to the contrary. So there's a lot there as well. You know, we should be looking at, you know, what the State Department is doing in terms of implementing, you know, President Biden's executive orders on equity and how that's sort of transforming, you know, the foreign affairs bureaucracy and how that affects the way that diplomats talk about themselves in the world. And of course, there's a whole, you know, range of, you know, different China policy related topics that, you know, interested national committees could just start digging into. You know, how has the Biden administration been influenced by, say, groups that want a dovish approach and urge, you know, people not to speak about the CCP's malign influence? You know, that's another important issue. So, you know, I think the difficult thing for lawmakers in the next Congress is going to be, you know, setting those priorities, because they have no shortage of things to look at. So they're going to need to be selective and figure out how to best allocate their time.
Yeah, I was going to say, unsurprisingly, if you asked me, I would say, we'll start with my cover piece on the lab leak theory from a couple months ago and just continue from there. But I, what Michael had laid out there, I think it is really worth a deep dive into how we became almost overnight the kind of, from a constitutional republic in which the people's rights were first and foremost and laid out in the Bill of Rights, to the kind of country where you could get arrested for being outside on your waterboard or taking your kids to. Now, I realize these were rather extreme examples, and usually the case of a police force or some sort of nanny state run amok, but it did not take very much to get us to a point where people in local government felt the right, you know, Gretchen Whitmer deciding, well, no, you can't buy seeds in Walmart. You're only allowed to go certain aisles. That aisle has to be taped off. You can't do that. Yes, of course, these were dumb decisions, but I'd really like to get into, like, did people understand the kind of lunacy that they were empowering, and why did it take so long for them to realize that they had empowered this kind of petty fascist, quasi-fascist, you know, nanny state government? The second thing is, obviously, we need drastic overhauls at the Food and Drug Administration. And honestly, I think at the CDC, and I think monkeypox is a fantastic example. Like, oh my God, COVID-19, what a disaster. Well, look, at least we've learned some hard lessons and we'll be real prepared for the next pandemic. Well, here we are. It is July 2022. And after saying, well, look, we have no choice but to close the schools for a whole year. Never mind all the learning loss. Never mind all the social, emotional, psychological issues this is going to create in kids. Never mind how we're disrupting the life of every working parent in the country. We have to do this. It's the only way to keep everybody safe. And now here we are a year later, and it's like, do we need to tell people to stop the orgies? Nah. Just be careful when you're doing your orgies. Go ahead. Go ahead. Be our guest. We're the CDC. We're not going to stop you. Yeah. So that's where we are. All right, I asked what you would want them to do. My exit question is going to be, if the GOP wins the House, and let's say this, you know, perhaps the Senate, what aspect of the pandemic response will get the most attention and imagination? I'll start with you, Michael.
Oh, gosh. You'd never go broke underestimating the incompetence of Republican House investigators. So it'll probably be some crazy thing like, you know, did Dr. Fauci get personally enriched by Moderna or something like that? Just foolishness. You know, not that questions about the pharmaceutical company's relationship to regulators aren't a valuable topic, but I can imagine it taking a very vindictive and personal turn when what we need is forensic accuracy and you know, searching inquisition. So yeah.
Jimmy Quinn.
I think Michael's probably right. I think that that's kind of that's going to be the, you know, the headline approach. I do think though that you know, beneath the surface there will be a more substantive look at COVID origins. You know, that subpoenas will go out to EcoHealth Alliance and people within the public health bureaucracy. There's going to be a major, effort to examine documents and get a hold of, you know, all of this information. So that's also going to be a big push. But, you know, it might get crowded out a bit by the personal focus on Fauci.
I was going to say, if we all have the same answer, then it's probably not a good question. But alas, that's kind of what I figured. I think, you know, people love drama, people love conflict, and people love personalities. And I think Fauci is the face of the pandemic policies. And I think there are a lot of Republicans who'd love to have a YouTube moment of them berating Fauci or other government officials. And, while I understand the red meat aspect of that, the whole point of these hearings is to get information. Ideally, you learn something you didn't know earlier. And I don't know if enough Republican lawmakers understand that's the point. I think they want it for, you know, a viral YouTube fundraising moment or something like that. All right, that's a rather dark note to end on, but we have room for lighter items. So, Michael Brennan Doherty, what happy things are going on in your life?
The happy thing going on in my life is just preparing for an August vacation. I think half the delight in a vacation is just the anticipation of it. And my family goes to the beach every other year or so. Yeah, in New Jersey, and we go with all of my extended family, my in-laws. So all the cousins gather together, all the kids, all the grandkids, grandparents. And it's just fun to kind of like start loading up the pile in the corner of the living room of beach toys, beach towels, and all the little things you need to get it together. So we're in that mode of life now, and it's quite fun.
Jimmy Quinn, what's going on light and happy in your life?
Well, it's my birthday tomorrow, so I'm looking
forward happy birthday, Jimmy.
Thank you. So I'm looking forward to celebrating, you know, getting dinner with my family. I celebrated with some friends last week. So very much looking forward to that.
All right. I may have mentioned on one or two of these podcasts, my older son is really into rock climbing. He did not get it into, for me, I don't like being more than like 3 feet above the ground. About a week ago, he said, I want to watch this movie called Valley Uprising. It is currently on Amazon Prime, if you have that. And it's basically the story of rock climbers in Yosemite. And it goes from the 1950s through the 60s up all the way up pretty much to the modern day. And it's really kind of fascinating to see how the rock climbing community has mirrored changes in American culture and American society through that whole time period. By the way, all these people are crazy. Some of them have died. Sometimes they fall off the rocks. A whole bunch of them love to do it without safety lines and things like that. I've told my son he's never doing that. But just absolutely a lot of footage. It will just have your heart in your throat as you see these guys on these, you know, 1-inch ledges and climbing, put their fingers into little crevices and stuff. Absolutely gripping and absolutely fascinating. And I say that as a guy who was only interested in rock climbing because his son is into it. It was absolutely fascinating. So, all right, moving on to editor's picks. Michael.
Oh, my pick is Kevin Williamson had this utterly vicious corner post on manly men and whether Donald Trump qualifies one and whether the Claremont Institute is in the right position to peg which man is manly and which one is not. You will find it on the corner, and it is quite hilarious, especially if you click through the links to see what he's really putting down there.
Jimmy Quinn, what in the pages or web pages of National Review has jumped out at you lately?
Andrew Studdiford has a very important piece in the latest issue of our print magazine, making the case that what Russia is doing in Ukraine is a genocide and an attempt to end Ukraine, you know, as a nation and the Ukrainian people as an entity as well.
So there are a lot of good options these days, but I think what kind of jumped out at me this morning, our Brittany Bernstein has a piece about Eric, is it Greitens or Greitens? Or Eric Abominable, the terrible Eric.
I think Greitens.
Greitens, but... okay. You know, remember the guy who used to be the governor of Missouri and then he had not just skeletons in his closet, but a woman tied up there? That guy, okay? But what Brittany does is she walks through that, you know, not that long ago, he described himself as an Obama fanboy. He was a registered Democrat. He drove to the Democratic National Convention in 2008 when Barack Obama was nominated. Now he's not only is he a Republican, he's the toughest and meanest and most right wing of the Republicans. In fact, he's the rhino hunter. And it all seems like a giant act, and he's a giant phony, in addition to all of his other copious character flaws. So if you're in Missouri and you're thinking about who to vote for in that Senate primary, check it out. Well, we've had our editor's picks. We've had our lighter items. That is it for this edition. Now, this is the point where Rich would usually tell you any rebroadcast, retransmission, or account of this game without the express written consent of Major League Baseball is prohibited. But come on, people. No one should be asking Mother May I of Rob Manfred. Now, if you want to offer someone an account of this podcast, I say go ahead. Tell them Jim said it was okay. But you know what? It's probably just easier to tell them to listen themselves. This podcast has been produced by the incomparable Sarah Schutte, who makes us sound better than we deserve. And in addition, I don't know if people recognize this, she edits The Morning Jolt. And most mornings I send it to her in the form of a combination of Morse code and semaphore flags, and thus needs to be translated into printed English. Thank you, Jimmy Quinn. Thank you, Michael Brendan Doherty. Thank you, Sarah. Thank you, listeners. This is The Editors, and we'll see you next time. Unless Rich decides after how I've done, I'm never on this podcast again.